right, it is time for another episode of The Fifth Estate. My name is Jay Caruso. I am here along with my co-host, Mr. Neil Dewing. How are you, sir?
As well as can be expected, Jay. As well as can be expected.
How's that fantasy football team doing? I'm doing well.
Oh, my fantasy football team? It's best we not speak of that. I don't want to...
Not much better.
I don't want to spoil the mood.
Oh, okay. All right. Yes. Well, as you guys know, as we always talk about here when we start off this show, actually, you know what? I wanted to say something else first. Somebody had asked, what song is that opens the show? And that is the great Charlie Parker, a song called KC Blues. It was actually written by Miles Davis. So you have, you know, two great musicians there collaborating on that one particular song. Charlie Parker, great song. As always, we ask if you like the show, if you like what you hear. You know, if you're not subscribed already, we assume you're subscribed. Tell others to subscribe. But really what we'd like you to do is go out there to iTunes, leave us a review, leave us a rating. The iTunes gods love that stuff, and it leaves us in an area where more people can be exposed to the greatness of the guests that we have on this show. I don't want to take any credit.
Absolutely. It's not us that they come to listen to, Jay. It's the high caliber of guests that we're somehow able to draw to us to elucidate and illuminate the issues. So
speaking
please
of which,
subscribe.
Yeah. And speaking of great guests, you know, we have another one. You know, all of our guests are great. That's what makes a show worth listening to. Again, it's not us, it's our guests. We are happy. We're gonna be talking about, a wonderful thing. A great thing about the internet is that there's information out there for everybody. One of the lousy things about the internet out there is it seemingly has made everybody an expert on every subject there is known to man because they can look it up.
Only, not really.
Right.
They don't actually know what they're talking about. And we have with us tonight Professor Tom Nichols. Who, if you will allow me to list some of the credentials here, Professor of National Security Affairs at the U.S. Naval War College, Senior Associate of the Carnegie Council on Ethics and International Affairs, Fellow of the International History Institute at Boston University, a five-time undefeated Jeopardy champion, and an author of several books. Professor Tom Nichols, how are you?
Good evening, guys. Thanks for having me. I'm terrific. I'm still kind of grooving on that excellent intro music.
It is quite excellent. It is quite
excellent. I mean, it brought out my inner Rat Pack.
That's what we're going for. That's what we're going for. So Tom, I listed your credentials there because the show's topic tonight is expertise and the I suppose the ways it is no longer quite as valued as it used to be or should be, one of the signs of an expert in their field is of course their credentials, their titles, the positions they've held. That is sort of a way to denote this person may know what they're talking about. So what do you do in the course of your academic work? What is your primary focus? National security, but what does that entail so much?
Well, the most important thing to start with is to say that I don't speak for any of those institutions, especially the government. I originally kind of divided my time when I was younger and earlier in my career between working in policy and working in education. And now that I'm older, I sort of do more education and less policy. But on an average day, what I do is I teach at the Naval War College, which is a master's degree level degree granting institution for mid-level military officers run by the Navy, where they get a degree in national security and strategic studies. And I teach at night at Harvard Extension, where I teach courses on nuclear weapons and the Cold War. I've also done a whole bunch of other things. I was a Senate aide. I worked on Capitol Hill. I worked in a think tank in D.C. I sort of had a kind of a typical career track for a guy that was a Russian-speaking Soviet expert back in the day. And so now I'm, you know, up here in New England, mostly doing teaching, although I do work with you know, within my daily government work, I, you know, work across the services and work on things like talking about nuclear weapons and stuff like that. Credentials are a part of an expert's identity, but experience and sort of what have you done lately are an important
of course. So, yeah. What have you done for me lately?
Yeah, you know, it's a lot of good universities have graduated a lot of stupid people.
I'm one of them. But no, here's the thing. You know, in terms of, you know, what have you done for me lately? I was thinking it might be useful for some of our listeners. If you could draw from your experience and draw from your academic career insofar as you can, you know, give us sort of a foreign policy picture today. I'm interested in the subject myself, you know, just in terms of kind of a current events thing, but it would also, I think, set us up to seek into this discussion of expertise.
Well, I think if you're asking for my view of kind of the current foreign policy landscape, and again, my personal view, it hasn't been this bad since the mid-1970s. Now, you know, it's hip for people who haven't lived through an earlier time to say, oh, this is the worst ever. I get that all the time, especially younger students say, this is the worst economy ever. This is the worst the world's ever been, because younger people always think that. But I really do think from a more, I won't say objective, but from a more considered viewpoint, this is pretty much as low as we've been since the mid-1970s. If you think about 1975, where we just lost in Vietnam, and you know, we were suffering through the oil shocks, the Soviet Union was pretty much running around the world doing whatever the hell it felt like, Soviet military powers expanding, ours was contracting, and pretty much the bad guys in the world did what they felt like doing without really having to take the United States into account. And I think we're back to that. And I think it's primarily, it's not because we're not capable. It's not because we're, you know, in 1975, our economy was on the rocks. We were really in dire straits. And I don't think that's true today, no matter what anybody running for office says. But I think it's because of the passivity of the Obama administration. I think this is an administration that just hasn't been very good at foreign policy, isn't really interested in it, thinks that America just isn't that positive an influence in the world, and has been trying to, well, I suppose the charitable term is retrench. I would say retreat from the world scene. And I think whoever the next president is going to have is going to have a real job on their hands trying to restore American credibility and American reputation in the world, right? Because I think that that's suffered mightily over the past 8 years.
Would you
and
say
that, that doesn't mean President Obama's reputation. I mean, part of the problem is, if you say that, people say, but President Obama is really popular. Well, he personally is really popular, but that doesn't translate to the United States being admired or respected. He doesn't have any foreign policy coattails that help out the rest of us in international affairs.
No, I mean, anybody who's traveled internationally, it trickles down even to that. I mean, people do sort of turn their noses up at Americans, and there's a lot of contempt that is openly expressed. Right. But that's certainly going to be something, a challenge for the next president. What are some of the other challenges in the foreign policy realm that you see?
I'm about to do the Mitt Romney dance here. You know, Russia is our major geopolitical adversary. And I didn't used to think that. I mean, I went through the Cold War. I was a Cold Warrior. But when the Cold War ended, I, like a lot of people, I thought Russia went mostly under the back burner. And I think objectively it did. But they're back, and you know, the Russians really are our most significant adversary. I mean, there's a war going on in Central Europe right now, and the Russians are doing things, including attacking and interfering with our elections, that could ignite into an actual conflict with the Russians. And I think we're not paying very much attention to that. So I think the next president has to think about a reset of the reset. I don't think it has to be, you know, reaching out and offering the hand of friendship, but I think that the Russians would respect a much more businesslike approach to dealing with them, including telling them point blank that they need to I don't know, can I swear on this podcast?
Yes,
sure.
They really need to cut the shit. And I don't think I think I would expect that more from a Clinton administration. I don't expect it from a Trump administration, because I think he's basically the Kremlin's candidate.
Yeah.
But that, I think that's the top challenge. I also think reforming our nuclear strategy. I mean, we're still limping along with a kind of half-assed Cold War strategy by default. Or I don't think our military is nearly as weak as Trump has portrayed it. But I think we've lacked direction. I think we've lacked a clear national security direction, because again, I don't think the Obama administration is particularly interested in that.
Well, I mean, there's an aspect to especially the nuclear question of readiness. You know, we may have the bombs, but do we have the capability to deliver the bombs if the worst should happen and a nuclear exchange is called for?
I think we do. And I think the bigger issue here, again, is deterrence is a purely psychological condition. We have more than enough nuclear weapons and they work just fine. And the problem is there anybody in the world who thinks we would actually use them or fight over anything, really? There's an argument brewing between conservatives and liberals about how far nuclear modernization should go and how many of these weapons we need. And my answer is, if you have 100,000 of them, it doesn't matter if people don't respect you and don't think that you're willing to fight for your interests. And you could have just one, and it would matter if people, you know, are really unwilling to cross you.
Well, look how much we jump whenever North Korea does a test, because we believe that the North Koreans would use a bomb, even if they only had two or three.
I think it's not so much that we think they'd use the bomb, it's that we think that they're just so batshit crazy that we don't know what they do, and that we don't have any idea who's really running that country. I mean, Americans, including me, I think, find it utterly fantastic to think that this kind of, you know, weirdo man baby with a bad haircut is running a country of 22 million people that has nuclear weapons, but apparently he is, and that itself is frightening. I actually haven't been that critical of the way the administration has responded to this, because I'll go back to the 90s and blame Bill Clinton for, you know, a bad deal that kind of set us on this road 20 odd years ago. But I mean, it's not so much that we jump, it's that we don't really know what to do. We do things like we fly B-2s over their head and say, there, that'll show them. Well, I don't think that really does anything. I think there's no substitute for conventional power. There's no substitute for naval power. There's no substitute for commitment and for, you know, an engaged president. And the one, I'll just wrap this overly long comment up by saying, I think the most consistent complaint I've had about the president and his policies is that he just doesn't seem engaged. I mean, Putin invades Ukraine, and they run a picture of him standing alone in the Oval Office in his shirt sleeves on the phone. And then the next thing you see him is on the phone with Putin, again, in a picture that you can't believe the White House would release, sitting in his golf togs in Florida on the phone. You know, this is just a message that says, look, we don't take things seriously. We understand if you don't take us seriously, do whatever you want. You know, we're not really your problem. We're focused internally, and we don't really care about international affairs. And the rest of the world has taken notice.
So that, on the flip side of on the flip side of the challenges,
and we're all doomed and eat at Arby's.
Of course, I never leave Arby's. But no, here's the thing: are there opportunities for us? Where are areas that we're doing well in our foreign policy, that we have room to grow?
And this is the thing that really makes me crazy, you know, about the way that Trump and this election have gone, is this notion that we are just this big, hapless, failed power. We are still the most powerful military machine in the world. We are still the largest economy in the world. And our culture, and I think this is something important that people forget, our culture, our currency, our language dominates the planet. We have a lot of power. We have a lot of leverage over the rest of the world. If only we, you know, show up. And I don't think it has to be leveraged or any of those other half-assed business school terms. I don't think that's our problem. I think it's just a matter of showing up and saying, look, there are issues we really care about. We get hacked by China And, you know, my information got hacked by China. And then we sort of shrug. You know, Putin invades Ukraine and we say, well, you know, we'll talk to the Europeans about sanctions. And again, we shrug. The North Koreans explode a nuclear bomb and we say, that's a terrible thing. And, you know, we complain at the UN and we kind of shrug. And I think that there are a lot of opportunities for American foreign policy because I think the world wants us to stop shrugging and to start leading again. And I think that that, you know, but if we're going to talk about you know, not backing up NATO or not defending our Japanese allies, well, you know, until this election is over, the rest of the world's going to hold its breath to decide whether we're checking back in or checking out.
It's an interesting take. What about in terms of foreign policy? Are you mentioned Russia, but what about who are still at this point? I mean, with the Obama administration, who remain our greatest allies at this point? And you know, going forward, I mean, either as the way it stands, Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump is going to be the president of the United States, and if you're advising them, who do they need to go to first? Who are like the first three countries they need to go to and say, okay, you guys are on our side, and here's what we need, here's what we want to kind of do as we move forward?
Britain, Canada, and Mexico. Traditionally, the first three that an American president should reach out to and talk to. Those are, you know, Canada is our, that's our sister, you know, that's family. If you think of it as a family, I mean, you know, Britain is our old, is our second, France is our oldest ally, but I think after Britain in Europe, Britain is our, we have that special relationship with Britain that needs to be rekindled. And then of course the French and Mexico, I mean, Mexico, you know, we live next to Mexico and we have to actually go there and remind them that we're a good neighbor, that peace, this is the first time, by the way, with the Colombian War finally ended. There is no war in the Western Hemisphere. We are remarkably privileged to live in an entire hemisphere that does not have an ongoing military conflict in it. And I think that if I were advising the president, I would say, you know, pick in any order, but I think you start with Canada, Mexico, and Britain, and then you go and you meet with NATO, because I think NATO has been sadly neglected in all of this. And in the past 8 years, and I think even in the Bush administration, I think that NATO and our European allies were sort of pushed aside while we were muscling around in the Middle East. And then we kind of came back to them once we needed them in Afghanistan. So I actually think there are a lot of opportunities there. And I actually don't think that we're better off in the world than we were under George Bush. Again, people mistake President Obama's popularity and President Bush's unpopularity with somehow confuse that with America's position in the world. And I think that's wrong. I think we're in a weaker position now than we were 10 years ago. Even with the Gulf War, I think we're in a weaker position.
Do you think that Putin is attempting to sort of exploit the tension between the NATO allies under the Obama administration? Do you think he's cognizant of that? And
Absolutely. And I think he's been using a lot of unconventional means to strike at the NATO alliance, including the use of Edward Snowden. This is something people have kind of let go of as Snowden has emerged into this kind of nerdy pop culture hero. But a lot of the Snowden revelations were directly aimed at disrupting the United States relationship with NATO. And, you know, call me crazy, but when a defector steals millions of documents and hides in Russia, and the next thing that happens is that all of the revelations are aimed at NATO countries, I get suspicious of Russian involvement.
Yeah. And let me
this will kind of lead back toward the expertise thing when we go there. But I kind of find it amazing when people say, well, you can't prove that any of that's true, as though common sense and any experience dealing with Russia at all are, you know, people are like dealing with this as though Russia didn't exist until last year.
Well, let me ask you about Putin a little bit, because, you know, I think a lot of people underestimate him in terms of his intelligence and the things that he's doing. Like you said, manipulation, that, you know, people kind of brush him off as like a thug, but there's more to him than that, correct? Am I wrong?
Yeah, well, I've had some interesting discussions over the past year with, pretty astute European Affairs watcher, Lawrence Friedman, well-known scholar at King's College. And the one thing that puts Sir Lawrence and I kind of outside a lot of other observers is that we both agree that Putin's not a good strategist. He's not smart in the kind of book smart sense. He's cunning the way gangsters are. I mean, take a character like Tony Soprano. Was he smart? No, he's an idiot. But he's cunning. He knows how to run his family. He knows how to run the mob, and I think that's what Putin is, because even though Putin has managed to stay in power, he's had a really long and good run as the dictator of Russia. He's probably going to stay there until he dies. He's also done things that in the long term, I think, are going to blow up in his face. I don't think NATO is going to go away. In Ukraine, he was, in theory, what he was trying to prevent was the creation of a pro-Western hyper-nationalist Ukraine. And what's he done? He's created a pro-Western hyper-nationalist Ukraine. So I think he's smart in some kind of gangsterish cunning sense, but I don't think he has any sense of long-term strategy. And I think he looks smarter than he is right now, because the United States has been a cooperative adversary that has been just blundering into loss after loss against the Russians, primarily through our own incompetence rather than through his sort of cleverness or craftiness.
So what's your prognosis for the...
better than he is, let me put it that way.
So Tom, what is your prognosis for the next decade or so? Do you see... Do you see that nice period of a lack of war in the Western Hemisphere lasting very long? I think historically we would say that's an aberration. But what do you see coming down the pike?
In the words of Mr. T, my prediction is pain. not so much in the Western Hemisphere, but I think that this we've entered a period of international chaos because the United States did not defend some fundamental requirements of the peaceful operation of the international system. For example, people always will come back at you about Ukraine or Crimea or even Syria and say, look, there's no U.S. interest there, right? People use this term, there's no national interest. Well, if you think that it's in our national interest to establish that conflicts in the international system cannot be mediated by military force, by borders can't be changed by force, right? This is the thing that goes all the way back to the Falklands and to the first Gulf War and the attack on Kuwait, that we've always stood for, look, you can't just change borders by force because you don't happen to like them. We've pretty much abandoned that principle. We've said, if you're the biggest gun nearby, you don't like the way things look, take out your pencil and redraw the map. And we'll stand by and we'll wring our hands and we'll say how unfortunate it is. I think that's opened the door to a period of real chaos over the next decade. Now, I think it could be temporary. I think, again, maybe I'm not entirely pessimistic that this is a lost cause. I mean, remember, I was talking about 1975, and within the space of a decade, we were at 1985, where the United States was on its way to becoming the single most powerful superpower in the world, and the Soviet Union was only 5 years from collapsing. So American leadership can make the difference, but I think that we're in for a tough 5 or 10 years because we've let a lot of genies out of the bottle. We took a pass, we whiffed on the Iran deal, we've let the North Koreans pretty much do as they please, we've only now started to stand up to China, dotting the ocean with its little make-believe islands. We've turned the other cheek 100 times in front of the Russians. There's a lot of trouble that we've stored up for ourselves that will all come to fruition in the next 10 years unless we really change course in foreign policy.
Well, thankfully, we have two great candidates running for president who I have every confidence. I'm sorry, I couldn't finish that sentence. Well, yeah, no. Hopefully our listeners now have an appreciation that Tom has a measure of expertise in this subject, and hopefully they also understand that Jay and I do not have a measure of expertise in this subject. It's part of the reason I wanted to talk about it, because I don't know that much about it, and Tom does. And when I don't know about a subject, I like to ask people who do. Jay, is that kind of your thing?
Oh, yeah. That's why we have people on the show to talk about subjects we don't know about.
It's kind of the point of this show. And that brings us to this discussion of the death of expertise. And this is an idea that actually I first came across in an article that Tom wrote for The Federalist called The Death of Expertise. And everybody should go read it. And Tom, maybe you could lay out the central idea of this, because you have continued to add to this idea over the subsequent years, and you have a forthcoming book on the subject. So I'm excited about that. So if you could maybe tell the listeners what the idea is and what it means.
Well, we live in a world of experts. I mean, people bristle at that term because it's exclusive, right? If I say, well, I'm an expert, it means you're not in something. But the fact is, you do live in a world of experts. The cop who patrols your street is an expert in law enforcement. The pilot who flies your plane is an expert in flying the plane. And it used to be that Americans accepted that, and they accepted it as part of a normal division of labor, that, you know, math teachers know about math, and diplomats know about diplomacy, and doctors know about medicine. We've entered a modern era of, and I think the word that comes to my mind most often when talking about this is narcissism, of arrogant narcissism, of the average person thinking that they can be an instant expert on anything. This is why we've ended up with people challenging their doctors about vaccinations. This is where, you know, people talk about going to the University of Google. This is where people, you know, listen to too much talk radio and they say, no, I know what's really going on in Washington. I really understand. And it's really disturbing, because this is happening at the same time that people, by a lot of measures, not by measures of literacy or kind of basic indicators in the West, but by measures of political literacy, people are getting stupider by the minute. And it's almost like the stupider they get, and here, you know, this will lead us into talking about the Dunning-Kruger effect. but it's Dunning and Kruger were two psychologists who proved that the stupider you are, the less likely you are to realize that you're stupid. And so it's been coupled to this kind of short-tempered narcissism in American society that not only shows no respect for that division of labor or for the role of experts in a society, but positively bristles with anger when you tell people that they're wrong about something. And
and anybody who has ever had a Facebook comment war knows this, and they see it, and you can tell when someone has gone to Wikipedia and is shooting facts at you that they just learned and they have no context for. So it's one of the most frustrating things. It actually really destroys, in my mind, the potential of the internet as a medium for communications. But I'm a bit of a drama queen in that regard.
But I don't think you're wrong, but I also don't think it's just the internet, because when I started working on this, people said, well, it's the internet, right? And I said, yeah, the internet's an enabler of it, but this has been going on for a while. And I think it's deeper than that, because, you know, there were always libraries and magazines and television and all of that stuff that were kind of the equivalent of the internet in their day. I mean, instead of people saying, I Googled, when I was younger, people say, well, you know, I read somewhere. And that was always the dumb people saying, well, I read but what's happened is, on top of that, we've had some failures of our institutions, particularly of public education, which has now become an exercise in therapeutic self-esteem building, so that children aren't told they're wrong. They're told that they're right in a different way, and that, you know, nobody wins. Or of course, we all talk about the everybody gets a trophy generation, but we're seeing that come to fruition. We have kids. I mean, I even see it in teaching. You know, I teach in a night school. I teach in a graduate school. I teach at night at Harvard. I've taught in a few other places, where you're seeing a whole generation come to fruition where they never really confronted the problem of someone telling them they're wrong. And, you know, I grew up with that. I mean, I went to high school in the 70s, and You know, I had teachers that had no compunction about saying, boy, that was a, you're stupid. You know, that's a stupid answer. Or, you know, kind of sit down. That's a wrong answer. You didn't do your homework. That I think has really gone away. So there's that and college. The other, I had dinner the other night with a guy that used to be a college president. And we, you know, we're kind of lamenting this, that everybody goes to college now. And that doesn't mean that everybody's more educated. It means that colleges have dropped their standards to capture as many possible prospective students as they
Absolutely true. Absolutely true. I mean, they've got endowments and they've got buildings to construct. I think that every college campus I've been to since I was an adult had one major construction project ongoing.
That's how they measure their success. Mm-hmm. And if you look around the country, you'll see that every dinky state college and teachers college and everything that used to be called a college is now rebranding itself as a university.
As a university, yeah.
And so that the danger there is then people say things like, well, you know, why should you think you're smarter than I am? I went to a university. And you know, of course, I'm being the infuriating jerk that I am. I put my hands up and I put air quotes and I say, no, you went to a university. You know, because the fact of the matter is that what used to be perfectly serviceable local colleges or teachers' colleges or are now, as I say in the book, they're rebranding as universities as though they all have a particle collider behind the cafeteria. And they don't. And, you know, kids are not only, then add in things like grade inflation and the ease of, public school admissions and things like that. And you have people who have graduated from high school and have graduated from college and they don't know anything, but they think they do because their walls are covered with pretty confetti and degrees and trophies and other marks of achievement that aren't real.
It makes
talking to them impossible.
Can I just break in to say that one of the reasons that I respond so strongly to the death of expertise, the entire thesis, is that since I was a child, I am not trying to toot my own horn, but I'm a reasonably intelligent human being. And of above average IQ, blah, 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 which I'm not going to tell because that's gross. But when I was a child, I caught on to this whole self-esteem movement, this the fact I'd realized because I scientifically tested it, I was treated the same whether I got a D or a B or an A, or if I turned in nothing at all and got a zero. I was not taken to task. I was not punished. I was told, oh, you're smart enough. You can do it. We know. We believe in you. So what did I do? Well, I started slacking off and enjoying my free time in the evenings instead of doing homework because I was getting no pressure. But when I got to high school, I had two or three teachers who really laid into me, really gave me the business. And what did I do? I respected the hell out of those people and I started to try for them. They made me better. So when I see someone, you know, when I see this trend in education and then the corresponding just, you know, well, I'm fine, whatever. Nobody's ever told me I was wrong. I see that. And it's like, ugh.
And it's terribly frustrating because I know, I've been a teacher now for almost 30 years and those teachers that you ran into in high school, I mean, I'm pretty much like that. I mean, I've taught in public and private institutions and good schools and, you know, middling schools. And students don't want to be told that they're good all the time. They want to know that their achievements are real. And the teachers who play down to them and you know, kind of dumb it down for their love and affection to make kids feel better about themselves, it's never been my experience that students respect that. And all you're doing is graduating a lot of very fragile personalities, because what happens is those kids graduate from college knowing that they're not nearly as smart as their teacher said they were.
Yep.
But having these marks of achievement, and this, I think, contributes to this very caustic, angry reaction to anybody telling them they're wrong, because it really strikes at a deep insecurity. In the book, I use a quote from C.S. Lewis from the Screwtape Letters, where he points out that the claim to equality, the people who say, I'm as good as you, No one who ever really believes that ever feels the need to make that claim. You know, that he says the scholar does not say it to the dunce, the pretty woman to the plain. You know, that people who say, no, I'm as good as you, you know, that I'm as smart as you are. That's all, you know, it's like the whole world has turned into Fredo Corleone, right? I'm smart, I can do things. When in fact, the manifest evidence is you're not smart. And I think that has created a terrible social situation where, you know, people walk in and tell their doctors, no, you know, you can't vaccinate me because I read something on the internet once.
I mean, if you want to put it in terms of virtue, it's a lack of humility. It's a severe lack of humility.
Well, it is a lack of humility, and it's coupled to an immaturity. Mm-hmm. I mean, part of growing up is realizing that there are things you know, and there are things you might be good at, and there are things that you're not. I mean, when I was a kid, I grew up in a working class neighborhood. You know, my parents were both high school dropouts, but they were, you know, well read. They read the newspaper. They read books. In that neighborhood, people who knew stuff were considered, you know, dispositive about something. If you ask my dad was a stamp collector, and if there were a bunch of guys in a bar talking about something, it was about stamps, they'd say, well, let's ask him. Now it's everybody, and again, I say this in the book, everybody has turned into Cliff Clavin from Cheers. You know, it's like, it's okay for a bar to have one Cliff Clavin, you know, people that may be too young to remember Cheers, but Cliff Clavin was the know-it-all. The local mailman would come in every night and say, well, you know, it's a known fact.
Little known fact.
You know, our studies have shown, Diane, you know, and he'd go off and say something stupid. Well, it's okay to have one of those colorful characters in the bar. When we're all that guy, things become impossible. And it used to be that people would say, well, this guy knows about stamps, or that guy knows about carpentry, or, you know, that guy's a cop. He knows about the law. That guy is a doctor. He knows which medicines you're supposed to take. And that's gone. Everybody wants to be the smartest kid in the room. Everybody wants to be Cliffy. And it's terrifying because, you know, when we're all smart, we're all stupid.
Right. And you talked about, you mentioned education. You were talking about colleges and universities, but even at the grade school level, where you said that students want to be challenged. And we were talking recently with Campbell Brown, who sits on the board of Success Academies, the charter schools, that are doing, from what I understand, very well in New York and in the Boston area. And these are students who live in poor neighborhoods who, you know, don't have both of their families, but they're challenged at these schools. They're challenged to do better. And like Neil was saying, you know, when you have a teacher that challenges you, and I've had them, I've come across them, and there are lousy teachers and there are great teachers. And the great teachers are always going to challenge their students in a way, not to tear them down, but to say, I know you can do better, but it's going to, you have to work hard at it. You know, it's not like, oh, there, you know, you didn't do so good, but you know, great try. No, it's more like, hey, you need to like buckle up and, you know, kind of do a little bit better. And like you said, they want to be challenged. And even at younger ages, wouldn't you agree? I mean, even at a young age, we've got to start doing that to prepare them as they move on.
I mean, there's an irony here because I didn't, in a first draft, as I was working on the book, I thought I should talk about K-12, and I kind of noodled it around with my editor. And the fact of the matter is I'm not an expert on K-12 education. So, you know, I avoided it, but my gut instinct as a parent, you know, dealing with a child and as a college teacher who's gotten kids coming out of high school and talking to them about their educational experience, that of course children want to be challenged. Nobody, it's a well-worn anecdote about how when you don't keep score during the soccer game, the kids keep score anyway, right? It's the same thing in classrooms, that you can tell all the kids that they're all special little snowflakes, but they know who the smart kids are, and they know who the kids who are good athletes, and they know who the kids who are good musicians. And somewhere in there, we became terrified of admitting this. And I think part of it, and this goes back, you can go back 50 years and read things by people like Richard Hofstadter. This is partly the reaction of people to an increasingly complicated world that they find terrifying. And this may be because this is where the internet and cable and other things come in. They're bombarded now by too much information. Mm-hmm. And the only way to sort it out is to assure themselves that they know what's important and that they really understand what they're hearing. And that, you know, that the dizzying pace of modern life is something they can control, when in fact, the only way to survive in a modern republic is to trust other people and to trust that they know what they're doing, just as they're going to trust you that they know what you're doing in whatever job you're in. I also think it's partly, and this goes back to education, it's partly this notion that everybody has to graduate and become an astronaut. You know, when I grew up, there were guys who said, hey, I'm going to graduate, I'm going to go to the drop forge or the lumber mill, or I'm going to run a restaurant, or I'm going to, you know, I mean, I have friends that are millionaires from opening pizza joints. They did better than I did. I should have been making pizza. And they said, that's, you know, I'm going to have a happy life. I'm going to get married. I'm going to have children. I'm going to make, you know, pizzas, or I'm going to saw lumber or whatever it is. Now everybody comes out of school saying, I have to go to college, and I have to major in journalism or international relations, and I have to do something that's really important and exciting and fulfilling. Well, the real world isn't like that. And so we have a lot of blunted expectations and a lot of kind of sullen resentment from people who years have been pumped up to be told that, you know, you can go work in the White House, you can write for the New York Times, mm-hmm. when in fact, we don't all grow up to be astronauts.
Not just that, but with the internet, now these people can see the lives that they want to be leading in the carefully curated social media feeds of millions or thousands of influential people. You can go and you can look at someone posting their fabulous pictures from their European vacation, or you can look at Kim Kardashian, you know, walking down the runway or doing whatever the hell she does these days. And you just compare your sad little pizza making life to an international superstar, and that's not fair.
Well, and it's breeding a huge amount of political resentment. And I think the internet and cable television, that's really important. This notion that, well, if I have a Facebook account and the dean of the Fletcher School has a Facebook account, then I'm just as smart as he is because we're both on Facebook. You know, if I have a Facebook account or a Twitter account and the movie critic for the LA Times has one, then why is his opinion any better than mine? Because I'm seeing them both on the screen right in front of me. Mm-hmm. And that's partly the internet, but it's also partly media, because it used to be, at least when I was a kid, maybe when you guys were getting a letter in the newspaper, that was a big deal. To be able to get a, you know, write to, even to your local newspaper.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, I had a letter in the newspaper, you know. Now it's, well, of course, I'm sitting here till, I'm comic book guy, and I'm hammering away on my, keyboard till 3 a.m. at the comments section at the New Republic or National Review or wherever I'm going, because I'm so important, because people have to know what I think. And I think that that's a very dangerous thing. That delta, that measurable distance between how they see other people living and how they measure their own lives is incredibly, incredibly dangerous.
I agree.
It's incredibly unrealistic.
It is. So what can we do about it though, Tom? I mean, how can we talked about, you know, getting kids while they're young and nurturing in them a willingness to be criticized, you know, to be torn down to their bare essentials by an influential teacher and then built back up. Right. But what can we do between adults? What can adults do to build trust? What can experts do to build trust?
Well,
can they?
It's going to take a little courage, and it's going to take a willingness to lose friends. Because James Traub had the writer James Traub had a great line. He said, it's time for, you know, the experts and the intellectuals. We need a revolution of the intellectuals. And he wrote this after Brexit, which of course was another one of those cases where a whole bunch of people voted for stuff they didn't understand and made decisions, you know, without really having any information about what they were voting about. And in the way I handle it is I simply have decided to stop pretending to take people seriously when they're wrong, and to be, you know, as firm as I can to say, look, you know, I'm your friend, I love you, I respect you, but you're wrong. And I do know, you know, people say, well, what do you think you know better than me? I say, yes, I do. that's exactly right. Generally speaking, odds are I'm more often going to be right than you are. What encouraged me about this, and the reason I'm saying this is, as I wrote, when I wrote the blog piece, the piece has had over, you know, as of a year ago, it had over 1 million individual views, not hits, but individual viewers. And I started getting letters from all around the world, from doctors and teachers and lawyers and, you know, one, a molecular biologist in Europe wrote me a letter, you know, and all of them had a common theme where they are now striking back. They are now at, you know, at dinner or with their family or when they're in a public space and somebody says, well, I disagree, to say that they are now lashing back and saying, I don't care if you disagree. You know, you don't get to disagree about this. And I think that that's actually a healthy thing. I think we've spent too much time worrying about how to couch things, you know, as carefully as we can. Say, well, you know, I think the U.S. budget, this is a common answer to a poll question. How much of the U.S. budget is spent on foreign aid? The average American will respond 25%. The average American citizen, when polled, will tell you they think 25% of the American budget is spent on foreign aid. Yeah.
It's like a fraction of a percent.
It's a fraction of a percent. It's 0.75%.
Right. When somebody's the question's always asked, how do we balance the budget? And people start, that's one of the first things they'll say, why don't we cut all the foreign aid?
Yeah. And so I think there's nothing wrong with saying, look, until you understand some of these basic facts, I don't really have to take your view on this seriously. You know, I don't have to stand there and say, well, you know, that's one opinion. No, that's a wrong opinion. And I think that a lot of experts and doctors, I mean, you're seeing it already with the vaccination
business,
where doctors are lashing out, and rightly, by defending their professional view and really slamming the anti-vaxxers hard. You're seeing it with other things. I mean, in the book, I talk about the raw milk movement. There are people that want to give raw milk to children. And, you know, doctors are finally stepping forward and saying, no, this is child abuse. You could kill your kid with raw milk. And we're not going to, you know, we're going to get the authorities involved. We're going to get the Center for Disease Control, public health authorities. So I think that's really important. I think it's long past time to shed this kind of faux egalitarianism. Because that, in the final chapter of the book, I talk about how that's really a threat to our political system. A republic functions on a division of labor with policymakers reliant on experts serving them, with experts treating policymakers as their clients. And when everybody's opinion is as good as everybody else's, well, experts are going to withdraw from that. They're going to say, well, you know, as one of the doctors on Jimmy Kimmel, Kimmel had a bunch of doctors complaining about vaxxers and, you know, saying, okay, fine. Here's the needle and thread. Do it yourself. And I think that would be a very bad thing for democracy. But that, so far, it looks like experts are kind of striking back and saying, no, all opinions are not equal. We're not going to have a debate about whether vaccines give you autism. And I think that's the only way to go at this point.
It's a good idea. Good idea. So, Tom, give us some details about the book. You know, when's it going to be out? Where can everybody buy it? All I can, we pre-order it already. Go ahead and let everybody know.
Yes,
go ahead and
can,
sell it.
Thank you. This is the shameless plug part of the program where I say, you know, $24.95 like Mad Magazine, $24.95 cheap.
Another cultural reference that a lot of people aren't going to get, but I do. I got them. I'm a big Mad Magazine fan. So
the book will be out shipping on February 1st. And you can pre-order it at Amazon or Barnes & Noble. It's already available for pre-order. If you want to read more about the book, it has its own page at Oxford University Press. And, you know, I'm more than happy to hear from angry readers who want to take issue with it, because I think that's how we learn. But it definitely puts a stake in the ground to say experts have to start talking back to the public, or else we're really headed for some serious trouble.
Well, I know I'm going to be pre-ordering a copy, and my only regret is that it wasn't published before the Republican primary, Tom.
Well, you know, it was supposed to be, and
you failed, Tom. Let me tell you about publishing, because I've read about it. No,
you know, that was something I was going to add about this whole business about expertise. It's not just that people disagree with you; it's they get inside where your area of expertise and then decide to lecture you on it. Like, I'm a Russia expert. And some people say, oh, you study Russia? Let me tell you about Putin. And it's like, no, why don't you just be quiet and I'll talk for a moment.
And it's like somebody coming into your house and rearranging your things or the pictures on your walls and they don't.
Or telling you what how you ought to redo your bathroom, you know, I'm just a guy who walked in off the street. But it was supposed to be out before the election, and I'm actually glad it didn't. I mean, I got weighted down with a bunch of stuff and my publishing date. My fault. Authors almost never deliver their books on time, and I wrote this in 11 months instead of 6 months like I planned. And I'm glad it didn't, because it would be getting drowned out by the background noise created by Donald Trump. This issue is bigger than Donald Trump, although Trump is kind of the ultimate expression that stupid is cool. Trump at one point, I quote him in the book, and that's one of the reasons I'm glad the book was late, because I was able to capture some of the Trumpisms and actually put them in the book. Trump actually said, the experts are terrible. Where have we got, listening to experts? And
listen to me, because I'm an expert on everything.
he's like, I'm just, remember he said, I have a very good brain, which is the way a lot of people think. They say, well, again, it's the Fredo Corleone rule. I'm smart.
Right.
Well, maybe, but you're not experienced or you're not trained or educated. And Trump really is the expression of every resentful, dumb person who resents being told what to do by somebody they think is smarter than them. And Trump is the guy who says, when I'm president, you won't have to listen to any of those people. You can do whatever you want, and nothing's going to be your fault, because you're smart and you can do things too. And I think that's disastrous.
Well, maybe the publishing time is fortuitous, because maybe in the cold light of day, when we're all hungover from this political season, it'll be able to get more attention, more traction.
I didn't want it to turn into a book that was too closely associated with the election, because I think I started writing it long before Donald Trump came along. And I'm hoping that the point and the debate that it's going to create will be here long after Donald Trump, I hope, loses. But I think the point still stands that, when nothing is verifiable as fact and everything is open to argument and everybody's opinion is as good as everybody else's, you get Donald Trump. And you get Trump saying things that are, patently stupid and falsifiably wrong. And people say, but that's his opinion. That's my view. Who are the experts to tell me I'm wrong?
Right.
When Trump says the real unemployment rate is probably 42%. Well, that's just, that again, instead of arguing with somebody to say, that's one idea. No, that's just stupid. That's just impossible. The Great Depression does not have a...
Well, he takes any little thing that he hears and he'll repeat it as gospel. I wrote something real quick today where he was talking about how he's like, the Google poll showed that I won the debate or I'm ahead. And did you also notice that Google is suppressing Hillary, they're hiding the bad stuff about her. So it's like he got two things wrong, because there is no Google poll. It was some kind of survey that Independent Journal Review had done. And then, the conspiracy theory about, if you type in Hillary Clinton, CRI, and it doesn't finish out criminal.
And sadly, we're at a point now where it's his opinion is good enough for someone to... run for president.
Well, even he said it, though. He's like, he admitted, he goes, all I know is what I see on the internet.
Well, the problem here is that we're now in a kind of post-truth, post-reality environment with Trump, where he says, I saw it on Google, and people say, that, as you said, that's good enough for me. Trump is the very embodiment of that, because I think part of the reason we were talking about earlier, we were talking about why is this happening? And I think Americans have become, in some way, very childlike, that we don't like to hear things we don't want to hear. We don't want bad news. We don't want to be told, that we can't eat chocolate and lose weight. We don't want to be told that, we should write a will. We don't want to be told that, again, we're not going to all grow up to be astronauts. And Trump is the champion of saying, if you don't want to believe any of that stuff, that's fine. Whatever you happen to think is the truth at that moment. And again, I find that really terrifying, that kind of social malady, that kind of social dysfunction, has found its champion in a political figure. He strings together things in random order as they suit his purposes, and unfortunately, that's what dumb people do. And I've taken a lot of flack on social media because I whenever I post something about Trump or Trump supporters, I always have the movie A Fish Called Wanda? Don't call me stupid.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The criminal auto, he says, don't call me stupid. And I just keep saying, okay, we're not supposed to call you stupid, but you know, at some point, what choice do I have?
Honestly, I don't know. I mean, I think you've got the right of it. And I, you know, I definitely urge everybody to go out and read this Federalist article on the death of expertise.
We'll put the link in the,
yes, we will. We'll link to it. We'll get you several million more hits, Tom. but just
to be clear, I mean, I do say that, look, experts can be wrong. It happens, but they're not as wrong. They're not as likely to be wrong as you are. Mm-hmm. And because people say, well, what about this one time that my doctor was wrong about what I had? Well, okay, that can happen. But Trump is the champion of that. And I talk in the book about conspiracy theories and confirmation bias. And Trump is the champion of that kind of thinking. I mean, he is all about the conspiracy theories, all about the, I heard a guy once say, you know, it's one of his favorite expressions is people say, a lot of people say. And that's a really dangerous thing because, again, conspiracy theories, it used to take them a lot longer to get off the ground. And with the internet now and with a political candidate, you know, mouthing them without being challenged from a media, and there's a chapter in the book about the media, turning into basically an entertainment complex that will let Donald Trump talk all day as long as, you know, the ratings are good. We really are devolving into kind of a pre-modern society. We're going backwards to where we were, you know, in the 19th or late 18th century, where any stupid, crazy conspiracy theory is part of our national life now. And I think that's just immensely dangerous. It's dangerous for our health as people, and it's dangerous to the health of our democracy.
It's a needed message right now. Well, Tom, we're going to go ahead and wrap, but we thank you so much for coming on to join us.
Well, I appreciate you guys having me on.
It's been eye-opening, and I've really enjoyed learning a bit more about it. We do have one more issue to cover, however. And this is the only gotcha question really lay on our guests. And we need you to bring your expertise to bear on this final subject.
Lay it on me.
Jay, go ahead.
You've seen Die Hard, right?
Of course.
The question is Die Hard a Christmas movie?
Of course it's a Christmas movie.
Yes.
Damn it, Tom.
Oh, yeah, man. You get to gather the family around and you know, you play the Ode to Joy and you have the Christmas lights. Come out to the coast, we'll have a few laughs. It's of course it's a Christmas movie. It's more of a Christmas movie than Christmas Vacation.
Wow, that's fighting.
Well, that's some people. That's just your opinion, Tom.
Yes, well, you know, I'll tell you. There's one other movie quote that's in the book, and it's a movie I know that everybody loves, and it's from the dude where he says, "Well, you know, yeah, that's just your opinion, man." which is pretty much the way everybody regards everything. But yes, Die Hard is a Christmas movie.
Oh well. Wonderful. Jay, you score another win.
Yet another one. All right. Tom Nichols, thanks again for being on. It was a lot of fun. Learned a lot. Looking forward to reading your book, and everybody else should as well. Go out there and pre-order that damn thing. Give Tom some money.
Yeah, because, you know, academics write books to get rich. Hopefully people will give it a read and they'll at least think about it without just reacting to it, which I think was the kind of the initial reaction. So hopefully you'll give it a read. Folks out there will give it a read and they'll give it a serious think.
Yep.
Which is really all I ask.
And also, you know, stop by the Federalist, check out Tom's work there. You can find him writing about national affairs and foreign policy and national security, all that good stuff. So we appreciate that, and we appreciate you being on. And my name is Jay Caruso. For Neil Dewing, we will see you next time here on The Fifth Estate.